Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I am your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great week wherever you are. It's that time of the week. It's Wednesday, time for another sit down, and we got a great show planned for you today. I know my co-host and I, we've been talking about this one for a while. We talk a lot about New York on the show, talk a lot about, you know, even Philly occasionally, but it's rare that we talk about Chicago. We've done shows on Mad Sam DiStefano, Tony Accardo, but people have been asking me, when are you going to get to Tony Spilotro? When are you going to talk about Casino? When are you going to talk about that kind of stuff? And we're going to do it today. We got a huge episode. This guy wasn't a big man. He was called the Ant because he was such a small guy. We're going to talk about Tony Spilotro today on the show. And, you know, we're going to even talk a little bit about Mad Sam DiStefano, who's obviously very important in the life of Tony Spilotro. We're going to talk about Tony's time, not only in Chicago, but out in Las Vegas. And I know our co-host tonight is very excited about that. It's our friend, Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, Vegas is close to your heart, so I'm sure you're excited about this one. How are you doing tonight?
Yeah, buddy, I'm real excited about this. I mean, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Las Vegas over the last few years, and, you know, that town, more than even New York, that town isn't what it is without the mob, right? Like, it just doesn't become this sort of mecca that it has become without the mob's influence in the building of that town. Because, you know, as much as the, you know, we're going to talk about the skim and we're going to talk about all this stuff, the mob was fundamental in building a lot of those original iconic properties that went up, you know, the Stardust and the Fremont and all these places that kind of started Vegas down the road that led to where it is today. And Tony Spilotro is one of the absolute critical guys in the construction of what we know of as Las Vegas today.
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked about these kind of people before on the show, these guys that become expendable, they get way out of line. They start doing things they shouldn't be doing. And, you know, Tony Spilotro played with fire, and he played with fire for a long time. And eventually he got really burned. We're going to talk about that and more. As always, hope you're having a great week. Make sure if you are just checking us out, make sure you check us out on Twitter at TheSitDown7. You can check us out on YouTube as well. Just search The Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. Make sure you go and subscribe. Let's get into the show. This is going to be a long one. Not 3 hours, but it's a subject that requires a lot of information. Yep. By the way, Blackjack, before we get into the show, it's Super Bowl week, so obviously, you know, it's always a fun week for gamblers, and I'm sure a lot of people out there will be betting the big game. Should be a good one this year. Obviously, we don't have to deal with Tom Brady, which is nice. Feels like we've seen the Chiefs a lot. Two brand new teams we haven't seen, in a while. Cincinnati hasn't been to the Super Bowl in forever. You get the young kid against the aging veteran who finally has a shot to win one. Should be a great game. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to the game, and I'm just going to say this because I know a lot of our listeners also dabble in sports gambling. I could not be more on the Rams in this game if I tried. I think that the LA defensive line is going to dominate Cincinnati's offensive line. That, to me, is the biggest mismatch in this game. The Rams have skill position players all over the field that are capable of making plays. Stafford's playing some of the best football of his career. I absolutely love the Rams in this game. I think the Rams win this game pretty big.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Obviously, we'll see if the flame burns on Joe Burrow. But, you know, look, you got to respect it. I do get the feeling for some reason it seems like they're just going to be happy to be there. Obviously, it's a Super Bowl, but we've seen this where kind of it's that veteran-laden team that's put everything into it to win it. We know that the Rams have obviously, you know, given up their entire future for a shot to win this year. So, it's going to be a great one. Good luck if you're out there wagering. You're going to make sure you wager responsible as always. By the way, before we get into the show, please check out our sponsors. We have a lot of great ads on this show. We've got to pay our bills somehow. So please check that out. Go check out Blackjack Fletcher on Twitter. Check me out on Twitter. But without further ado, let's stop talking. Let's get to the Tony Spilotro episode here on The Sit Down. Tony Spilotro. Anthony John Spilotro was born May 19th, 1938 in Chicago, Illinois. Tony's father was actually from Bari, which is in basically southeast Italy, basically in the boot And he would actually arrive in Ellis Island in 1914. So he'd have been about 20 years into his stay in Chicago when him and his wife would have their sons. He would ultimately start running a restaurant in an area of Chicago that was fairly Italian, a big Italian enclave. He would run a restaurant called Patsy's, and it was very well known throughout the underworld. It was frequented by a lot of different mobsters. And Blackjack, there was one thing about Patsy's that was world famous. According to many mobsters, Frank Collada would talk about this years later. He would grow up around Tony Spaccia. He said that Patsy's was known. It was like a luncheonette, a place where wise guys congregated, but it was very well known for its meatball sandwiches. Now, I've said before, I think one of the perfect foods on earth is a meatball. I could eat meatballs forever. You never get sick of meatballs, do you? It's like, there's nothing better than a nice long roll with a little cheese. Meatballs are a great food, aren't they?
Absolutely they are, especially when they're done right. You know, when you fry them up in a pan a little bit, finish it in the oven so you get that crisp on the outside and it's juicy on the inside.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah, such a great meatball. But so he would run Patsy's, and he would obviously move around with some mobsters. He wasn't exactly in the light, but he definitely was someone that you know, was very positively around people. Growing up, Tony would actually have four brothers that would follow him into the life. He actually had one brother who actually didn't follow him into the life, but for the most part, the Spaccia brothers were involved in crime. Tony would be first arrested in his teens for shoplifting. And by 21, it was estimated that Tony Spaccia had been arrested over 10 times. He would ultimately, during some of his early years, him and his brothers ran a shoeshine business. This is actually kind of interesting. And he would develop some territory around his father's store. Well, one day, a young curly-haired kid with glasses started moving in on the shoeshine territory. According to legend would have it, that was Frank Culotta. And he remembered Tony Spaccia came up to him and asked him who he was. And they had found out that their dads knew each other. And they had actually would become lifelong friends. But during those crimes, Tony Spaccia would start more and more getting into different crime. He was stealing cars, doing robberies, hanging around with gangs. And would eventually drop out of high school. As we've talked about time and time again, school for a lot of these people was not in the cards. And Tony Spaccia realized quickly that the guys in the black suits and the nice cars were the guys he wanted to be. And he would tell Frank Collada basically that, you know, his lifelong goal was to be an outfit member. And he would quickly start kind of, you know, getting involved with major people. The sad thing, though, in 1954, Tony's about 17 years old. His father, Patsy, would die. And that would really kind of have an ever-changing effect on Tony Spaccia. Look, I think he was always meant to do what he does. But when you're a kid, and we've talked about this with certain people. When you're a kid, let's say 10, 11, even 15, 16, 17, and you lose your father, that's a huge thing. You have to wonder, can you go on without it? He had brothers and stuff, but that's a big point in someone's life. And, you know, Blackjack, at that point, Tony Spaccia was almost dead set into crime already. So this would just kind of magnify that.
Yeah. I mean, listen, losing your dad at that age is something that I can't, you know, I can't imagine. And it obviously would be very, very hard. And as you mentioned, he was already going down this road. So now you remove really any sort of impediment or any sort of positive role model to say, hey, maybe you shouldn't be doing this. I think at this point, Tony Spaccia's fate was kind of decided.
Yeah. And, you know, in his early 20s, Tony Spaccia would make his foray into kind of organized crime. He would begin doing bank messenger robberies and kind of doing some hijacking. That was a big thing, obviously, in the mob. We've seen that in New York. And, you know, he was a great burglar. I mean, that would be something that Tony Spaccia would have throughout his life. He was a little guy, though. They called him kind of the pissant. That was one of his words that he was referred to. And that would ultimately be where he got his nickname. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that he was a little guy. I mean, he was 5'5". And that's why when we watch Casino, Joe Pesci's character playing Spaccia, it was such a great cast because didn't Pesci just kind of exude who Spaccia was?
Pesci was able to look like him physically, but as you said, the thing, it's the way he carries himself, right? I mean, it jumps off the screen at you, and when you know anything about Tony Spilotro, that's the way he carried himself, right? Like, he was a guy who, even though he was 5'5", was bigger than life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and by the early 60s, as we know, with the outlook of where Chicago was, Mad Sam DeStefano was creating this large juice loan business. We talked about that in his show, and he obviously was a very demented individual, as we know. He would start hiring these young kids to do his enforcement, and Tony would attract the attention of Mad Sam DeStefano. He would start collecting, and you know what he also started to do was kill people, and that's where Tony Spilotro was always well known. He was someone that was very well adept at taking out the laundry, and he would start pretty early. By 1962, at the age of 24, he's involved in a very important murder. There were two individuals, Billy McCarthy and Jimmy Maraglia. They called him the M&M twins. They were basically thieving and doing a lot of shit around the neighborhood, and they needed to go. There was a big issue with them, and Tony was given the contract. He would ultimately take care of that double homicide, and that would be his first foray into killing. We also know that one of the individuals that Mad Sam DeStefano was involved with was William Action Jackson. As we know, Action Jackson, we talked about this during the Stefano show. This was a very grisly murder. This was the murder where, you know, they were shoving stuff up things, and it was very graphic. It was said that Tony Spilotro was at that murder as well, alongside DeStefano and other people. So he was getting his foray into murder very quickly. By 1963, he'd be involved in another murder of a guy called Leo Foreman. Leo Foreman ultimately was a juice loan collector. He had his own clients. He wasn't ultimately kicking up to Mad Sam DeStefano. And, you know, at the end of the day, that was another murder he'd be involved with that ultimately he would be indicted on years later. But the problem that Tony Spilotro had was he wanted to be more. He didn't want to just be a hitman. He wanted to be a powerful individual. He wanted to be the boss. He wanted to make money. And that was really the issue. He felt like, I think ultimately they were using him a little bit, you know, but that's kind of what you're kind of drilled into, where you become this kind of one trick pony. We saw that with Roy DeMeo. Roy DeMeo became just a killer. And, you know, he felt like he was more, but he was never ultimately that respected. So Blackjack, Tony Spilotro is doing his thing. He's moving up in his 20s. He's doing stuff that most 20-year-olds don't do. But it seemed like he wanted more.
Yeah, I mean, listen, at 24 years old, you kind of do what you have to do, right? And at this point, they needed him to do these things. And also, I mean, you have to realize he was kind of, you know, brought along at this age by DeStefano. And DeStefano was a guy who was more than content getting his hands dirty. So that's kind of where he fell. But yeah, I think that from an early age, it was apparent that Tony Spilotro didn't want to just be a hitman. He was interested in doing more than that. And that kind of precipitates ultimately his move to Vegas later.
Right. And, you know, by the early and mid 60s, Tony Spilotro started branching out a little bit. He became getting involved in bookmaking, and that would happen on the north side. He was also, as we know, in the outfit. Every outfit, let's just say capo or someone that's in the streets, they're getting kickups from all the independent bookmakers and or any wire room in their area. I actually, interestingly enough, Blackjack, interviewed a guy in Chicago today on our YouTube channel. He was a Chicago outfit bookmaker for about 20 years. And he basically told us that, there were wire rooms all throughout the city. There would be people that would come collect every day. Or every month, every week. And they would also have the independent people that were kicking up. So Tony Spilotro is making a lot of money. Any person doing business in those neighborhoods were kicking up to Tony Spilotro. And this is where ultimately Tony would meet Frank Lefty Rosenthal, who, as we know, was a master gambler. He excelled at setting odds. He was basically an elite level gambler. He was one of the most influential gamblers in the country. And he would kind of take a liking. They'd take a liking to each other. By 1967, the feds would ultimately raid the home of Tony Spilotro on bookmaking suspicions. And interestingly enough, he'd be arrested by them in that raid. He would tell the feds, quote, make sure you remember me. And the feds would kind of put him on their radar. He kind of assumed that he was going to be something in his life. And, you know, he was a cocky little prick. That was pretty clear. He would ultimately get a lot of heat, and the outfit decides that, you know, by this point, their casino operations are continuing to strengthen and strengthen out in Vegas. And they would send Tony out there to kind of get a change of scenery and to deal with you know, the casinos. I'll ask you, Blackjack, looking at the thought here, this seemed like a bad decision to send him out there, didn't it?
It does. It does, because you're essentially sending a guy out there who is not going to have a lot of management. He's not going to have a lot of oversight over him. And you're kind of sending him, I mean, you know, for lack of a better term, out to the Wild West, right? I mean, he's going out to Vegas at a time when everything in Vegas is kind of there for the taking, and they're not going to have nearly as much control over him as they had in Chicago.
Yeah, and look, at this point in Vegas and out in Los Angeles and everything, the Chicago outfit was really doing some good things. They had an individual out there, Marshall Caifano, who was handling, you know, the outfit duties out in Vegas. The problem that he would have is, ultimately in 1964, he would be arrested for extorting different businessmen and that sort of thing. And Marshall Caifano is given 10 years in prison. So the outfit had a power vacuum issue out there. And, you know, Tony Spilotro had made it clear, and he had did some good things in the bookmaking world, and his connections were coming back to help him. He obviously was doing murders. He had, by this point, did everything he had to do. And early in his life and in his career, he wasn't the same arrogant nut job that he would become out in Vegas, but sending him out there will ultimately be a problem, which we're going to get to. So he goes out there, kind of establishes some direction with Frank Rosenthal. The problem that he has when he goes out there is, as soon as Tony Spilotro gets out to Vegas, within a couple of weeks to a month, the murder rate continues to kind of skyrocket. And people are kind of wondering, like, what's happening? And it kind of coincided with Tony Spilotro's arrival.
The one-man crime wave.
Yeah, basically. Like you keep in mind, in the 60s in Las Vegas, I mean, it's not like Chicago or Philly or New York. Like, it's a sizable city, but they didn't have, you know, tens of murders each day or shootings. It was this town that really wasn't having a ton of murders. So if you have two or three murders every couple of weeks, that's a lot.
Yeah, Vegas was a small town back then. I mean, it's easy to look at Las Vegas today and see what it is. But even today, Jeff, for those of you who have been to Vegas, you know what I'm talking about here. When you fly into Vegas, you see the Strip and the communities right around there, Henderson, and, you know, the little towns right around there, Summerlin. And then it's nothing but desert. Take 70% of that away in 1971. You know, I mean, Vegas was a small town surrounded by desert, and Tony Spilotro comes out and people just start dying left and right.
Right. Exactly. It's kind of crazy. It kind of didn't help him at all. By 1971, Frank Rosenthal would be put in charge of the Stardust Casino. And obviously, as we know, there were multiple casinos, particularly Tropicana, Stardust, a couple others that were basically mob run. They would put businessmen, they would put fronts, you know, kind of to deal with the blowback and have a solid name on the liquor board, if you will, kind of thing. And the mob was skimming back to Kansas City, back to Chicago. And Chicago was in control of that. They were the only ones in control of it. And Frank Rosenthal was a perfect guy. He would start kind of as a floor manager, and then he would rise up and be kind of the big boss there. The problem he was having was Tony Spilotro, as usual, was, you know, kicking up dust. Tony would set up a headquarters inside a gift shop inside the Circus Casino. And he would kind of use that as a front, if you will, and start doing business. He was loaning money. He was doing things. And he would also have to deal with some stuff back in Chicago. He would be indicted, Tony Spilotro, on the Leo Foreman hit back in 1963. And this is where everything would kind of go down with Mad Sam DiStefano. Obviously, as we know, in 1973, Mad Sam DiStefano is also indicted for that hit. And he starts his nonsense where he's screaming into bullhorns at court days. He's being wheeled out in hospital beds, just doing real nutty shit, which we talked about. He became expendable. And obviously, you had to wonder, if you were Tony Accardo and other people, we obviously can't trust this psychopath. Someone go shut him up. So on April 14th, 1973, Tony Spilotro is summoned to kill Mad Sam DiStefano. We all know he's in his garage. Spilotro walks up and they shoot Mad Sam twice with a shotgun. tearing off his elbow and basically hit him in the chest. No one was ever charged in the murder. So Ed Sam DiStefano had to go, but it ultimately would work out for Tony Spilotra because he would become, you know, he'd basically be acquitted in that murder. So this was tying up several loose ends. DiStefano was a nut job and had to go. He knew too much. And now Tony could head back to Vegas and not have a murder hanging over his head.
Yeah, I mean, DiStefano had to go, right? The crazy routine was far too dangerous to let play out any longer. And yeah, it freed up Spilotro to go and do more of what he wanted to do out in Vegas. So as far as Tony Spilotro is concerned, it's a win-win.
Yeah, and by this point, I mean, keep in mind, Tony Spilotro had been married. He had married a woman called Alice Stewart back in the 60s, and he was happy. But once he went out to Vegas, things started to change. And in the mid-70s, this is where Tony Spilotro had obviously lived on the edge. He was doing things. He was kind of a hothead. He was you know, making waves in the casino and things like that. But he really started to delve into some dangerous territory. As we know in the mob, whether it's Chicago, whether it's Philly, whether it's New York, it really doesn't matter. There's one rule. You do not sleep with the wives of connected friends of ours, as we know.
You don't.
By this point, and if you know anything about Casino, you've seen the film. Sharon Stone plays a woman called Jerry. Franken married her. She was a showgirl. She was a drug addict and had major issues. But have you ever seen the real Jerry?
I have.
I mean, absolutely stunning.
I mean, a beautiful, beautiful one.
Yeah, very attractive. And okay, I'm going to tell you something about me right now. Okay. And I think I know where Tony was going here. As a young guy who is not the tallest person in the world, I'm 5'8", but Blackjack, there's something hot about a woman that towers over you. I don't know. Maybe it's the, I don't know what it is, but I get the feeling for Tony. He saw this ravaging tall woman and said, I got to have some of that. And he didn't care. According to Frank Collada as well, he would mention that Tony Spilotra actually had a major issue with this. He had been involved with a couple different women that were dating friends of his. So this was a problem for him. And he starts an affair with Jerry Rosenthal. And he had to basically keep this a secret. And eventually he would tell Frank Collada, and Collada basically said, look, this is not good, man. Like, if this gets back to the outfit, they're going to whack you. If Frank finds out, that's not going to be good. So he was dipping into private stock, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, it's kind of a hard and fast rule. You know, you can't do that. But again, we talked about Spilotro being a hothead and doing things his own way. He didn't really care. He was going to do what he wanted. And he did that in this case. And I mean, listen. Jerry was a beautiful woman, as you said, but that is dangerous territory to be in.
Right. And not only was Tony Spilotra having to deal with that, but he was starting to have some money problems out in Vegas. He's starting to do stuff he shouldn't do. And then some issues start to arise in Chicago. Lefty finds out about the affair. It was kind of a weird situation. Lefty calls Jerry and it rings for a while, and then eventually Tony picks up.
Yeah.
It's almost like, why? Like, why'd you pick up, bro? Like, that probably wasn't a good idea. Not only does Lefty have issues with his wife and with his home situation, but he starts to have issues with the Nevada Gaming Commission. They start to figure out who exactly Frank Rosenthal is. So if you're Chicago, you're looking at this. If you're Tony Accardo and some of the other Joey Ayupa and people like that, you're starting to wonder, what the fuck is going on in Chicago? We have millions of dollars tied up out there. We've got this nut job in Tony Spilotro. We have Lefty, who is doing good things, but you know he's starting to be not as clean as we thought he was. Things are just kind of falling apart. In 1976, Tony Spilotro's having money issues, right? So he's having all these problems. He compounds the problems by he kind of sets up this burglary crew where he would sell stolen merch out of a pawn shop he had bought. So the job was he bought this pawn shop and would start fencing stolen material that he would use and get from these businesses that he was robbing. He would set up a crew alongside Frank Collada. They'd call themselves the Hole in the Wall Gang. They would just go around starting robbing and doing big scores at businesses, banks, all sorts of things. And they were all kicking up to Tony. They were making a nice piece. The problem with burglary. And this is always an issue with it, is it's not easy. You got to spend a lot of time scouting things and making sure about alarms and all sorts of stuff. Plus, remember, Blackjack, when you steal shit, so let's say you steal a ring, you're only going to off that for 30% on the dollar. And you then have to kick up to people above you and split up with everyone. So at the end of the day, it's really hard to eke out a solid living, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, 30% is a generous figure in some instances, because honestly, the more expensive the thing is you're stealing, the harder it is to fence it because people are looking for it. So it's a tough thing to do, you know, and then you've got the factor that Spilotro may not have been the greatest planner in the world or the most patient guy, hence the name the Hole in the Wall Gang, because they had a tendency to just drill holes in exterior walls, which again, probably not the most nondescript way to commit a burglary.
Yeah, the thought really was, if we don't have a way in, we'll just drill in our own fucking hole. We'll just bang down the wall.
Just knock a wall down and go in.
Yeah, really savage, quite honestly. By 1978, also, things were coming apart out in Vegas. The FBI would start suspecting that there was major involvement in the casinos in Vegas. And they would set up a pretty big investigation known as Operation Strawman. And this would be all about wiretapping the phones of mobsters, particularly in Kansas City and in Chicago. And if we remember from the film, that Nino Remo Gashi character, he would have been Joey Ayupa in present day, and they were reporting to Kansas City. And by the late 70s, there was a lot going on, not only at the Tropicana, but the skin was being figured out. The FBI would learn that there was an individual controlling the skin, not only at a Tropicana, but at other casinos as well. And that the individual, Joe Augusto, who ran the Tropicana, was secretly sending cash from the casinos directly back to Nick Civella, who was the boss of Kansas City, Joey Ayupa. Cleveland was getting paid. St. Louis was getting paid. Milwaukee was getting paid. Everybody was getting paid. And this would ultimately lead to the indictment of not only Civella's in Kansas City, but other people that were involved in the skim. So this would make a big problem, particularly for one essence of the skim in Las Vegas. It would take some time, though, to bring it all down. There were also, again, it just seems like problem after problem would come up for Tony Spilotro. So let's kind of recalibrate what's going on for Tony right now. Lefty's having issues at the Stardust. Tony's running out of money. He's fucking his best friend's wife, and he's trying to hide it from the mob back in Chicago, all while doing burglaries and making himself very known to the federal government. We would also have another problem. An individual that was involved with him in murders called Sherwin Lisner decides that he gets arrested and starts singing to the federal government. Frank Collada is sent to kill him. The problem that Collada would realize is Tony went off half-cocked and just told Collada to go kill him without getting any commission approval from Chicago. And this is where Tony, it's believed that Tony Spilotro is made expendable at this point. He's a loose end. He's going rogue. He's completely out of control. And it was becoming mightily clear that the individual bringing down the skim, you know, was the FBI, but it was also people like Tony Spilotro. You think if they had sent out someone a little bit more even keeled, it'd have been a lot easier. It'd have been a lot more easy to deal with. But you sent arguably the biggest nut job out there. He's almost like Nicky Scarfa from Philadelphia, just a half-cocked nut job who became obsessed with power and money and was willing to just kill people without any approval and was just doing it. The Hole in the Wall Gang would also fall apart as well. It would be found out that an FBI informant would actually infiltrate the group. And in 1981, on July 4th, the final job for the Hole in the Wall Gang would be a furniture store called Bertha's on East Sahara Avenue in Vegas. They decided to do it on July 4th because they felt it would be easy with all the fireworks going off. They could muffle the sounds of the things they were doing and get in. The problem was this FBI informant obviously was, you know, wired for sound, and the FBI had set up breaking it down. That night, the crew, including Frank Collada, Ernest DeVino, Lawrence Newman, Wayne Metecky, and others, are all arrested and charged with burglary, conspiracy to commit burglary, grand larceny, and other possession of burglary tools. So everything's falling apart. Now Tony has to worry about the fact that his people are being jammed up. And Tony would actually end up skating on this. He never got arrested, but he wasn't helping his people out. When you have a crew, Black Chick, and they all get pinched, the nice thing to do would maybe be to pay their bail or something like that. Yep. Tony Spadro basically said, fuck you guys, I'm not doing anything. And people were starting to get pissed off. And, you know, I think he'd ultimately have to realize he was going to have to face more than just the outfit.
Yeah, Spilotro was in a world of hurt here, right? I mean, between the issues with the Hole in the Wall gang, his problems with Rosenthal, the outfit back in Chicago, and then there's just the changing of the tide in Vegas, right? Like, we're now into the time where Vegas is turning legit. Like, Steve Wynn has made significant inroads into Vegas at this point. He's a guy that the government trusts, and they're backing him on a lot of his land and casino plays because he doesn't have the mob ties that guys like Rosenthal had. So their power was getting reduced on all fronts. And Spilotro's out there just going crazy at every turn. I mean, at some point, he becomes not much different from Sam DiStefano.
That's exactly right. And it's interesting, and that's such a great point, but I'm glad you brought it up. I was going to bring it up if you didn't. That's exactly who he became. He became an expendable nut job who went off half-cocked and just started doing stupid shit that you can't do. And as we know, the one thing about Chicago that I have to give respect for, I've always found Chicago to be kind of the uppity group, right? The classy guys. They're not flashy like John Gotti. They're just going to take you out and deal with you. There's not a lot of, and this is how Chicago's worked for so many years. This is
a more tightly run ship.
Yeah, this is how Tony Accardo never went to prison. It was a tightly run ship. And once you got out of line, you were dealt with, and you were dealt with damn quick. And you're right. That's 100% right. Tony just became his mentor, Mad Sam DiStefano. Eventually, Tony would be arrested in 1982 for racketeering. And you know, he would also get another indictment. The problem was Frank Culotta, his longtime friend, his friend really since he was a boy, was sick and tired of Tony Spilotro. He obviously wasn't helping him. People were starting to get pissed off. And he would hear on wiretap Tony discussing the fact that, quote, we've got to take care of our dirty laundry. And that would be a direct indication that they wanted Culotta dead. He believed that Tony believed that Frank Culotta was going to rat him out. And he was right. He never would end up getting to Frank. Frank Culotta in that year would flip and become a government witness. He would eventually take the stand and testify. The problem was Tony couldn't be linked to any murder. So he was on the way to maybe beating another rap. The problem is by this point, Tony had been indicted for the skim. Him and Joey Iupa and all these different guys are being pinned in and brought in. So the end was near for Tony Spilotro, but the outfit decided we're not going to even let it get to a trial. On the early morning hours of June 14th, 1986, a group of Chicago Outfit members would gather in the basement of a home in Bensonville, Illinois. The head hitman was an individual called James Marcello. He would be tasked with going and picking up a Tony Spilotro. That day, Tony got a call and basically said, we need to have a speak. We have to have a talk. Tony would then phone his brother, Michael, who would end up following him into life. Michael Spilotro is kind of an interesting guy, Blackjack. He would actually be an actor at one point. He actually played in Magnum PI, if you've ever seen that show. He was involved in a couple different TV shows, interestingly enough. But Tony would call his brother that day and basically say, look, I think I'm in kind of some issues here. Can you come to this meeting with us? So the Spilotros get into the car. They're then taken to a basement. By the time they get to the basement, it was pretty clear Tony Spilotro realized this was it for him. He would ask the hitmen, can I say a prayer? At that point, they'd begin beating him and his brother. They would beat him to death, basically. They would then, almost incapacitated, be put into a car and taken to a cornfield. At that point, in Indiana, like we saw in the movie Casino, there would be a hole dug. They would be thrown into the hole, basically still alive. And it was said, according to people that I've talked to that heard about this during the time, they would tell me that the genitals of both individuals were actually shoved in each other's mouths. That's what I've heard. And they would be buried alive in an Indiana cornfield. Now, a couple of days later, on June 22nd, 1986, an Indiana farmer called Michael Kins was spreading chemicals on a cornfield when he came across a newly dug grave. Suspecting that some kind of poacher had buried a carcass of a deer, he would call a biologist friend of his from the Indiana Division of Fish and Wildlife, and he would drive to the site and start digging. He would later learn that the grave concealed not the remains of a deer, but of a human body. And according to the Chicago Tribune, he said a shovel would hit something in the midsection as he dug. He thought to myself, this is a person. I'm not going to dig anymore. He would then call the Newton County Sheriff in Indiana, and deputies arrived at the scene. They would continue excavating the grave and found not one, but two bodies stacked on top of each other. And the bodies had been indicated they were badly beaten and stripped of all clothing, including their underwear. Dental records would confirm they were the bodies of Anthony Spilotro, who was 48, and Michael Spilotro, 41. That was that for Tony Spilotro. He had worn out his welcome. And you have to ask yourself, could this have been one of the biggest mistakes the outfit ever made? I'll say this. Ultimately, I don't think this is why the outfit was jammed up, but I don't think it helped. Tony Spilotro became expendable. And we've seen with Carmine Galante, with Mad Sam DiStefano, with all these people, Roy DeMeo, some of the behavior by you is really your high wiring act. And that's going to be that, because at some points, these businesses are here to make money. And when you step out of line, they're not going to let you go to prison. They're just going to kill you. And that was that. Tony Spilotro was dead at the age of 48, Blackjack.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't think it's a mistake that they took him out. He had to go. I think maybe they should have done a better job disposing of the body. I mean, if you're going to take Spilotro out, you probably should do it out in Vegas. I mean, bury him out in the desert. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres of desert out there. It's going to be tough to find a body. As opposed to a farmer's private cornfield. That doesn't seem like the greatest place to put a body. But no, he had to go, obviously.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this would really kind of mark the unofficial end of Vegas with the mob. Ultimately, all the individual players were brought in, including Joey Iupa, Joe Doves. He would be jammed up for the skim. Everyone was ultimately indicted in 86 for skimming profits. Jackie Cerrone would take over at one point for Tony Accardo and Joey Iupa in the outfit. It would be estimated the conviction of some of the different mob ties. I mean, they were making millions of dollars every year, and you know, this would be the end for it. I mean, obviously we know what Vegas is now. It's this obviously very corporate place that, you know, we don't see any mob anymore, but we have to credit the mob for one thing. They built Las Vegas for what it was. It was 100%. That simple. And interestingly enough, Tony Spilotro was the last of really the Mohicans out there. Oscar Goodman, who's a known lawyer, he would end up becoming the mayor of Las Vegas. He would tell a journalist, John Smith, that, quote, Tony's death left a huge void, not only in my law practice, but in my life. He would be quoted as saying, until Tony got killed, I didn't realize how much time out of my life he took up. It was like I had nothing to do. It was like my whole life was taken up by Tony Spilotro, and everything else was ancillary and had to be fit into little niches. The press would also discuss that they kind of got sad when Tony went away as well, because Tony Spilotro was a full-time job for reporters. He was constantly in the news and was really, you know, kind of, you know, a debutante. He was someone that people wanted to see. And this would really end kind of that 40-year run that Vegas had for the mob. I mean, from the days of Mo Daylitz to Benjamin Bugsy Siegel to obviously Frank Rosenthal to all these other people. Now, I do want to mention there is something that I didn't get to that we saw in Casino. At one point, Tony would try to kill Frank Rosenthal. He would actually wire a bomb in the car of Frank. Now, lucky enough for Frank, he was able to get out just in time. He'd be, you know, beaten up and not look great, but he would ultimately get the picture. And that's kind of when he decides, and we remember seeing it in the film at the end, he just kind of, you know, decides, all right, that's enough for me. I'm going to go back to my regular life and just gamble. But yeah, that was that. Tony Spilotro really end the years of Vegas. And I'm sure we'll do some other Vegas episodes soon when we get into some of the other individuals in the outfit, but this would mark the end, Blackjack, of the mob in Vegas, really, in the mid-80s.
It certainly would. You mentioned Oscar Goodman, and I think one day we should do a show on Oscar Goodman because he is a character in and of himself, a guy who is, I think, one of the greatest criminal defense attorneys in the history of this country, represented Meyer Lansky, Nicky Scarfo, Phil Leonetti, Lefty Rosenthal, obviously Tony Spilotro, and a guy who really became kind of like the embodiment of Las Vegas. I mean, Oscar Goodman to this day is still kind of Mr. Las Vegas. You know, you can find him most nights sitting at his steakhouse down in on Fremont Street, Oscar's Steakhouse, which is a beautiful restaurant, you know, having a martini at 6 o'clock at night. He's a fascinating character. And yeah, he was intricately involved with the mob out in Vegas.
Yeah, you know, I interesting enough, if you ask me, give me five people you want to interview, Oscar would be towards the top of my list. You know, he's actually from Philadelphia, I believe.
Yep. You know? Yep. Went to the University of Pennsylvania Law School.
Yeah. I'm actually going to try to make that happen. If I have to go out to Vegas, I will. But as we get, you know, bigger and bigger, that's obviously something I think is more and more possible. I'd love to get to him soon. I know he's an older guy, but what a great
character.
Yeah. What a great and interesting guy. Couple more things about the Chicago outfit, about some of the people we talked about. Frank Culotta would ultimately beat the rap. He would obviously cooperate and become a government witness. He would enter the witness protection program. He ran a business and lived, I believe, in Mississippi and a couple other places. In the mid-90s, he obviously realizes that he doesn't have to live in silence anymore and leaves the witness protection program. He would actually become an advisor for the film Casino, and he would help the directors obviously get the film right. I'll tell you right now, Blackjack, Frank Culotta actually passed away, I believe, in 2020. You talk about a fascinating person. I'm not a big fan of informants, but one informant that I always was very interested in hearing from was Frank Culotta. He actually had a terrific YouTube channel called Coffee with Culotta. He used to do some things with the Mob Museum. Really interesting guy. Did a terrific interview on Vlad TV one time. Just really interesting guy. He ended up just kind of living in Vegas the rest of his life and had a pretty decent career. He would ultimately make some money through his story. And as I said, I believe he passed away in 2020 due to coronavirus. But, you know, all these people, so fascinating, really, from Tony Accardo to Frank Culotta to Tony Spilotro, guys that shaped Chicago for what it was. And ultimately, this is America. This is history. The mob ran a lot of things, and they ran Vegas for about 40 years.
You can't tell the story of Las Vegas without the mob being a significant chunk of it. And unlike a lot of the things in New York, where you could make the argument that the mob had a very negative influence, and they certainly had a negative influence in Vegas to a degree, Vegas doesn't become Vegas without the mob there, because the mob saw what they could do in Las Vegas, and they pumped money into it as well as taking it out. So a lot of these casinos don't get built up into what they are without the Chicago outfit there. And I'll tell you what, and I know you've been out there, Jeff, if any of you guys are going out to Vegas soon, you know, I know it's fun to go out and gamble and drink and do all that stuff. Take a trip to the Mob Museum, downtown Fremont Street. It's a great museum. It is an unbelievable museum. Go there, go to Oscar's, have a martini, maybe see Oscar Goodman. Have yourself a little bit of a different night in Vegas.
Yeah, the individual, ultimately, a couple other people, the individual that would be the head hitman in the organization to kill Tony Spotcher and his brother was James Marcello. He would ultimately be hemmed up for not only this murder, but others as well, in a trial called the Family Secrets Trial. He would ultimately be sentenced to life imprisonment. And he is currently at the age of 78 in ADX. 78, not good. That's a rough one. I will advise you guys as well, it being Super Bowl week and us kind of being in the Chicago mood. Like I said, did a really good interview on our YouTube channel with a bookmaker that was in, he wasn't in the Chicago outfit, but he worked for the Chicago outfit. Just a fascinating guy, John Merges. He now spends his life as a gambler and a big Vegas guy. I urge you to go check that out on our YouTube channel. But we're in the Chicago mood this week, Blackjack. But you know, you really were the star of the episode, I have to say. That correlation between Spalatra and DeStefano was surely there. Great one as always. I'm glad we're able to get in Chicago. We'll have to do some stuff on not only some of the other guys. We'll even do you know, Nick Savella in Kansas City. I always like getting out of New York occasionally.
Me too. Right? Me too. I like getting out of New York every now and then. Get someone a little different involved here.
As always, check us out on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. And make sure if you enjoy the show, you're checking it out. Make sure you hit us with a 5-star rating. Let us know what you think in the iTunes or Spotify review sections. And, you know, reach out to us if you want and let us know what you think of the show. I get so many new people every day. Hey, I love the show. Love this. Love that. Before we go, Blackjack, give me a score of the Super Bowl and an MVP. Who you got?
31-13 Rams.
Steph. Wow. 31-13.
I think this is a throwback game, Jeff. Listen, and I'm not trying to disrespect the Bengals here. What they've accomplished has been impressive, but I just can't escape the feeling that we're looking at one of those Super Bowls where one team just doesn't quite fit. I mean, yeah. The Rams, as you said, are a veteran team. You've got guys like Aaron Donald, Matt Stafford, Von Miller, Odell Beckham, who probably know on some level, listen, I don't know if I'm going to get another crack at this. It's in their home building, which I don't care about the home crowd. It's just, it's easier being at home during this week. Like, there's just less stress being at home. I can't help but think that Cincinnati, the clock has probably struck midnight on them. I love Joe Burrow. Joe Burrow is the one thing that scares me in this game. But I genuinely believe that the matchup between the Rams defensive line and the Bengals offensive line is the most lopsided matchup in this Super Bowl, much like last year's, where, you know, the Chiefs were a great team, but their offensive line got decimated by Tampa's D-line and they just couldn't do anything. And I think that's what we see in this game.
I'm going to go 30-21 Rams. I think the over is a decent play. I do think the Bengals can get maybe to 20. I think they can aid this total. I think Burrow's just too good a quarterback. Jamar Chase, I think they can find the end zone. I think the Rams will win. I think they will cover. Blackjack, I'm in a very good situation. I have the Rams 15-1, Bengals 40-1. So I'm pretty, you know, obviously, if the Bengals win, I'll be happy. But I believe that the Rams will win this football game. I'll go MVP. Gotta go. I'm going Cooper Kupp, man. I mean, the kid has been incredible. I think he gets behind this, to me, very average Bengals secondary and has a big day. I think, obviously, you know, I'm sure Matt Stafford will get it, but Cooper Kupp's been legendary. He might be the best receiver in the NFL.
It's been one of the most impressive seasons by a wide receiver I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I mean, this and Calvin Johnson that season when he absolutely went off. Are the two most impressive I can remember seeing. And Cooper Kupp doesn't quite get, I think, as much attention as he deserves.
No, he doesn't. That's a good point.
If you think about with the quarterback play this regular season that was kind of up and down for everyone, I don't know how Cooper Kupp's not your MVP.
Yeah. You know, I heard a great connection. Doesn't he kind of remind you of Steve Largent a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, he does. You're right.
I'm trying to remember who it was. It was someone, it might have been a YouTube colleague or something, but he's a great, you know, he was a great player. And I, you know, Cooper's terrific. Big fan of his. He's been awesome. I think we both agree Rams get the job done. We'll find out on next week's show. As always, we appreciate you listening to the Sit Down. Hopefully you enjoyed Tony Spilotro, a real pissant with a cocky attitude that ultimately had to go due to his nonsense. I will say, in final, it would have been hard for me to say no to Jerry Rosenthal as well. Just saying, Tony.
It's been hard, but I think I'd rather live.
Well, he was never killed for it, ultimately. it definitely didn't help.
Didn't help.
Yeah. By the way, one of the great scenes in the movies is that last scene in Casino where De Niro's sitting in his San Diego home and he's like, here's where I am, back where I started, you know, just, you know, everything's gone, his life's finally normal again, and he's just, you know, goes off into the sunset betting, and, you know, it's a great scene. That's a great film, nonetheless. But as always, thank you for watching the show. We will catch you next week here on The Sit Down. Have a great evening.